Welcome to Love's Tender Flame. Tales of Romance. I'm Mardell. Reading Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Dewar Miller. Chapter 12. Once in the little office, Crane did not immediately speak. He drew up two chairs, put a log on the fire, turned up the lamp, and in short made it evident that he intended to do that cruel deed, sometimes perpetrated by parents, guardians, and schoolmasters in interviews of this sort. He was going to leave it to the culprit to make a beginning. Reed, fidgeting in a nearby chair, did not at once yield to this compulsion, but finally the calm with which Crane was balancing a pen on a pencil broke down his resolution, and he said crossly, "I understood you had something to say to me, Mr. Crane." Crane threw aside pencil and pen. "I thought it might be the other way," he answered. "But yes, if you like, I have something to say to you. I have decided to break my lease and leave this house tomorrow." "You don't mean to go without paying the second installment of the rent?" "Why not? The Reveilles have broken, or rather have never fulfilled their part of the contract. I took the house on the written understanding that servants were to be supplied. And you are my witness, Mr. Reed, that tonight I have no one left but a cook."
"Oh, come, Mr. Crane. We only agreed to provide the servants. We could not guarantee that you would not dismiss them. You must own they showed no inclination to leave the house."
"No, I'll not deny that," returned Burton grimly.
"No sane man," continued Reed eagerly, "would allow the payment of his rent to depend on whether or not you chose to keep a staff of servants. In many ways above the average, you'll not deny, I think, sir, that the cooking has been above the average."
Crane had reached a state of mind in which it was impossible for him to discuss even the culinary powers of Jane Ellen, particularly with Reed, and so he slightly shifted the ground. "Let us," he said, "run over the reasons for which I dismiss them. The housemaid for calling one of my guests an old harridan, the boy for habitually smoking my cigarettes, for attempting to strike Mr. Tucker, and finally for stealing a valuable miniature belonging to the house, the butler for again introducing this same larcenous boy into the house disguised as a lame old man. The question is not whether I should have kept them, but whether I should not stay on here and have them all arrested."
Reed's face changed. "Oh, I hope you won't do that, Mr. Crane," he said.
Burton saw his advantage. "I should not care," he answered, "to go through life feeling I had been responsible for turning a dangerous gang loose on the countryside."
"They are not that, sir. I pledge my word they are not that."
"There is a good deal of evidence against that pledge."
"You doubt my word, sir?"
"I feel there is much more to be explained than you seem willing to admit. For instance, how comes it that you are I will not say welcome, but at least assured visitor in my kitchen?" Reed felt himself coloring.
"I do not feel called upon," he replied, "to explain my conduct to anyone."
"In that case," said Crane, getting to his feet, "this interview might as well end. I shall leave tomorrow, and if you and your friends, the Reveilles, feel yourself aggrieved, we can only take the matter into court. If the record of these servants is as excellent as you seem to think, they can have nothing to fear. If it isn't, the whole matter will be cleared up."
This was the crisis of the conversation, for as Crane moved to the door, Reed stopped him.
"Wait a moment, Mr. Crane," he said, "there are circumstances in this connection that you do not know."
"Yes, I guessed that much." "If you will sit down, I should like to tell you the whole story."
Crane yielded and sat down without giving Reed the satisfaction of knowing
that his nervousness at the expected revelation was as extreme as Reed's. The Reveilles, Mr. Crane, are among the most respected of our southern gentry. They fought for the original liberties of this country, and in the War of Succession. Crane nodded. I know my history, Mr. Reed. But, sir, the distinguished position and high abilities have not saved them from financial reverses. The grandfather lost everything in the war, and the present owner, Henry Patrick Reveille, has not been completely successful. Last winter, a breakdown in his health compelled him to leave the country at short notice. His four children, Mr. Reed, two boys and two girls. Four grown children, Mr. Crane, the eldest is 26, the youngest 17. They were left with a roof over their heads and a sum of money, a small sum, to provide for them during the absence of their parents. Not a satisfactory arrangement, sir, but made in haste and distress. Mrs. Reveille's devotion to her husband is such that in her alarm for him she did not, perhaps, sufficiently consider her children. At the moment when left alone, their difficulties began to press upon them. Your offer, your generous offer, for the house was made. There was no time to submit it to their parents, nor, to be candid with you, would there have been the slightest chance of Mr. Reveille's accepting it. He has never been able to tolerate the mere suggestion of renting Reveille Hall. But the four young people felt differently. It was natural, it was, in my opinion, commendable that they decided to move out of their home for the sake of realizing a large sum, the largest sum, probably, that had come into the family purse for many years. But an obstacle soon appeared. You had insisted that servants should be provided. Well, this was impossible. They tried earnestly. Miss Claudia told me herself that she went everywhere within a radius of 20 miles, except to the jails. At last it became a question of refusing your offer or of... Oh, well, I believe you've already guessed the alternative. This is not a time for the exercise of my creative faculties, Mr. Reed. What was their decision? Reed's discomfort increased. I wish you could have been present, as I was, Mr. Crane, on that occasion. We were sitting round the fire in the sitting room, depressed that Miss Claudia's mission had not succeeded, when suddenly she said with a determination, quite at variance with her gentle appearance, Well, I found a cook for him, and a mighty good one, too. Where did you find her? I asked in astonishment, for only a moment before she had been confessed an absolute failure. I found her, she answered, where charity begins. I own that even then I did not get the idea, but her brother Paul, who always understands her, saw at once what was in her mind. Yes, she went on, I found an excellent cook, a good butler, a rather inefficient housemaid, and a dangerous extra boy. And she looked from one to the other of her family as she spoke. Her meaning was clear. They themselves were to take the places of the servants they could not find. As Paul pointed out, the plan had the advantage of saving them the trouble of finding board and lodgings elsewhere. Miss Lily was opposed from the start, her nature exceedingly refined and retiring revolted. But no one in the Reveille family can bear up against the combined wills of Paul and Miss Claudia. How the plan was carried out, you know. There was a short silence. It was now some days since Crane had suspected the identity of his servants, an hour since Jane Ellen had turned at the name of Claudia and made him sure. Nevertheless, the certainty that Reed's confession brought was very grateful to him, so grateful that he feared his expression would betray him, and he assumed a look of stern blankness. Seeing this, Reed thought it necessary to plead the culprit's cause. After all, Mr. Crane, was there not courage and self-sacrifice needed? You see, this explains everything. The miniature of their grandmother was taken upstairs for fear its likeness to Miss Claudia might betray them. Miss Lily, who, as I said, never approved of the plan, was constitutionally unable to be calm under the accusation of stealing a hat, made, as I understand, rather roughly by Mrs. Falconer. I should be very sorry if your opinion of the Reveille family. I can't see what my opinion has to do with the situation, said Crane. Every moment now that kept him from Claudia was to him an intolerable bore. He drew his checkbook toward him. However, your story has convinced me of this. My only course is to pay my rent in full. Reed began to feel the pride of the successful diplomat. And one other thing, Mr. Crane. You see the necessity of not mentioning this. It would make a great deal of talk in the country. A young lady's name. Burton rose quickly. It was not agreeable to him to have Reed pleading with him for the preservation of Claudia's reputation. Here's your check, he said. Reed pressed on. And another thing will now be equally clear to you, I am sure. Miss Reveille cannot possibly spend the night here alone. That, replied Crane, is a question for Miss Reveille herself to decide. My motors are at her disposal to take her anywhere she may choose to go. And he opened the door as if he expected that Reed would now take his departure. But Reed did not move. I cannot go away and leave Miss Reveille here alone with you, he said. Of the two alternatives, said Crane, you might find it more difficult to stay in my house without my consent, but I'll leave it this way. Do you think Miss Reveille would regard your presence as a protection? I don't understand you, sir. Your last visit to my kitchen did not, I believe, inspire her with confidence. Shall we leave the decision to her? Reed went out in silence. He had had no reconciliation with Jane Ellen since that fatal kiss in the kitchen, and he knew she would not now side with him. He decided to go away and find her brothers. Lefferts, meanwhile, left alone, had stretched himself on a sofa and was smoking, with his eyes fixed on the ceiling. "My dear fellow," cried Crane with some compunction, "were you waiting to see me?" "I was waiting for my motor," answered the poet. "You know that, imagining this to be an ordinary dinner party, I ordered it back at the 11:15. "Where's Tucker?" asked Burton. At this moment, a step was heard on the stairs, and Tucker, dressed in a neat gray suit, adapted to traveling, wearing a cap and goggles, and carrying his bag, descended the stairs. On seeing his host, he approached and held out his hand. "Goodbye, Burton," he said. "I hope the time will come when you will forgive me for having tried too hard to serve you. For myself, I entirely forgive your hasty rudeness. I hope we part friends." Crane hesitated, and then shook hands with his lawyer. "There's no use pretending, Tucker," he said, "that I feel exactly friendly to you, and if you'll forgive my saying so, I can't believe that you feel so to me. You and I have got on each other's nerves lately, and that's the truth. How much that means, only time can show. Sometimes it is very important, sometimes very trivial, but while such a state exists, I agree with you, the two people are better apart. Goodbye." Here Jane Ellen, who had just finished putting the dining room in order, came out into the hall, followed by Willoughby. As she saw Tucker, she had one of her evil inspirations. Springing forward, she exclaimed, "Oh, wasn't it a pity, sir, you had to do your own packing? Let me put your bag in the motor for you." Tucker was again caught by one of his moments of indecision. He did not want Jane Ellen to carry his luggage, but he did not consider it dignified to wrestle with her for the possession of it.
so that in a twinkling of an eye she had seized it and carried it down the steps. But he was not utterly without resource. He had been holding a $2 bill in his hand, more from recollections of other visits than because he now expected to find anyone left to fee. This, as Jane Ellen came up the steps, he thrust into her hand, saying clearly, "Thank you, my girl, there's for your trouble." Jane Ellen just glanced at it, and then crumpling it into a ball, she threw it across the hall. Willoughby, who, like many other sheltered creatures, retained his playfulness late in life, bounded after it, caught it up in his paws, threw it about, and finally set on it with his sharp little teeth, and bit it into pieces. But neither Tucker nor the cook waited to see the end. He got into the car and rolled away, and she went back into the kitchen. Crane glanced at Lefferts, to whom plainly his duty as host pointed, and then he hurried down the kitchen stairs, closing the door carefully behind him.
Join me next time for another romantic chapter of Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Duer Miller, here on Love's Tender Flame. Until then, love deeply and live beautifully.